Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Today we're trying to get at a question from Samer, who asked about a town that isn't a town and the people who vanished from it. Producer Hannah McCarthy took the case.
This is Samer.
So, Samer noticed that in the year 2000 U.S. Census, there were three people living in Livermore, New Hampshire. But in the year 2010, they were gone. So he wanted to know what happened to them.
The concept of ghost towns kind of interested me anyway.
That's the tricky thing about this census question, Samer. Livermore is a ghost town, as in no longer alive. The town was abandoned about 60 years ago. Population zero. Oh, and it happens to be smack dab in the middle of the White Mountain National Forest. You go up a long dirt road, narrow in places where the river has washed it out, and there are ruins. Bricks crumbling into overgrown foundations. The odd bed frame or bank vault slowly becoming one with the forest.
Oh, cool, there's an old Pepsi can. Totally gonna get tetanus.
So, how did three people end up on the census for a ghost town on public land? Well, I kind of figured it had to be a hoax.
That's not really how it works in terms of, the census has a list of addresses that, you know, that they send forms to.
This is Ken Gallagher from the New Hampshire Office of Energy and Planning. It turns out you can't play a practical joke on the U.S. Census. They have a list.
Having the list of addresses first would prevent somebody living in Concord, for instance, saying, oh, I live in Livermore, that sort of thing. That just doesn't happen.
According to Ken, if the census says someone lives in Livermore, then there's got to be a place for someone to live in Livermore. The only problem is I couldn't find that place. Not on maps or search engines or in old phone books. Besides, we were talking about a national forest. Who lives in a national forest?
When you see the maps of the White Mountain National Forest, you might see one, you know, big green blob, right? This is where the boundaries are. However, that's just the maximum boundary of the forest. Within the national forest, it's much more of a patchwork.
And this is how I learned about inholdings, private land within public land. So that green blob, the boundary of the forest, it only tells you where the U.S. Forest Service can own land. But they don't own everything in there.
I would expect probably at least 10% of the land within the what's called the proclamation boundary may well be privately owned.
So it isn't that weird for someone to live in a national forest. But it is still pretty weird for someone to live in a town where, you know, nobody lives.
Essentially, we believe nobody lives there. But you might want to check with, like, Grafton County, the Grafton County office.
Good morning, Deeds Office.
So I took Ken's advice, and I called Beth Wyman at the Grafton County Deeds Office.
I have a question about what may or may not be an inholding in the boundaries of Livermore.
Yeah, I remember we have seen a deed before come through here in Livermore, but you don't know the name of the owner or anything like that.
Okay, listeners, at this point, I did happen to have a name. It was a name that popped up over and over again while I was digging around online. Two people that just might be the key to solving this mystery. Bob and Betty Shackford of Conway, New Hampshire.
Okay, yeah, I do see things listed for them in Livermore. And the latest thing I have was in 2005.
There are only 12 acres of private land left in Livermore. The rest is national forest. And all 12 are deeded, to this day, to the Shackfords. But that's where the trail went cold, because Bob passed away in 1992, and Betty, it turns out, died just this spring. But how did they end up owning the land in the first place? And why was Livermore abandoned? To find out, I spoke with Peter Crane, a White Mountain historian who did his doctoral dissertation on Livermore in the early 1990s. Livermore might be a collection of crumbling ruins now, but it had a good 50-year run. The town sprang up in the 1870s when two brothers, the Saunders, decided to launch a logging operation in the White Mountains. They built a town, a mill, and a railroad. Workers moved in and brought their families, and the brothers built a company store and then a school. And for a while, that town thrived, turning timber into lumber, lumber into cash. People were married, babies were born. By 1900, the population hit around 200. But then, things started to go downhill. The Saunders brothers died and left the whole operation to an attorney who might not have known how to run a lumber company. Population in 1920, 98. And then a fire destroyed the mill, and their one train on the Sawyer River Railroad fell into the river. And then there was a huge flood in 1927. That took out the railroad itself. Population in 1930, 23. And then, of course, there are the trees, the whole reason the town was built to begin with. In just a few decades, the loggers of Livermore had cut most of the good stuff. Population in 1940, 4 souls. By 1950, the town was empty. A year after that, it was disincorporated. Population in 1960, 0. In 1970, 1980, 1990, 0. In 2000, 3.
We have people all the time come up during the summer, and they're always curious of how we acquired Livermore, and I love telling the story on.
I met the Shackfords, 3 generations of them, in Bob and Betty's home in Conway after spending weeks tracking down a phone number. And I spoke with Matt, Mark, and Gary. That's Bob and Betty's grandson and 2 of their 3 sons. It turns out they tell their story all the time, because it's a pretty good one. When Bob first bought the place, there was an original Livermore house on the property, a 26-room mansion owned by those loggers back in the day. But transient hippies were in the habit of spending the night
fornicating in the bedrooms.
Yes, there was a lot of those.
Oh, they start tearing down the inside. Fire, you know, they'd rip it up all apart and here and there. You know, they wouldn't go out and chop wood. They'd just take
down a
banister. Nice and dry wood, you know.
Right.
Eventually, Bob had to raise the mansion, but he built the camp in its place, a little red cabin not far from the ruins of old Livermore. It was a cabin that he would share with his children and eventually his grandson, Matt, the man who holds the key to the Livermore 3.
That was me. I walked up to the gentleman. He was asking if we lived there. I said I'd like to, and kind of as a joke, I threw it out that we lived there, and at least for the summer. And he said that. So hopeful thinking, I think. I was wishing I could live up there for a year.
So that's the story. A census taker ran into Matt and his parents up at the old camp, and wishful thinking turned into official census data. None of the Shackfords are actually residents of Livermore, but their inheritance means a lot to them. All of them agree there's something still very much alive about Livermore.
And
you still feel it.
You really can.
You can feel the spirit of Livermore and the town.
I gave Sammer a call to let him know that I got to the bottom of his census question.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. So it is, it's kind of somewhat a clerical error, but it's an interesting journey to that clerical error. I thought for a second when you were talking about parcels of land, there's going to be some kind of origin for like a Stephen King novel or something. But this is also, that was a, the actual answer was also incredibly interesting, too.
My pleasure, Sammer. And who knows? If Matt Shackford gets his way, Livermore might find its way back onto the U.S. Census in a slightly more legitimate way.
I'd like to build a few more houses and get 12 people living up there and get be the first ones to vote and free up the town and...
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll do that.
Yeah.
Hannah McCarthy, our new Ghost Town correspondent, reporting on Livermore. Hannah, I really hope you got some pictures.
Oh, of course. Producer Sarah Plord and I got to go up there and explore what's left of the town. You can see those photos at nhpr.org.
So is Livermore worth a visit?
Yeah, definitely. The ruins of the mill especially are really beautiful. But if you go up there, please just admire the Shackford camp from a distance. There's no need to relive history.
Fornicating in the bedrooms.
Yeah.
From the sounds of it, it was pretty wild. Again, photos and more on the history of our White Mountain ghost town at nhpr.org. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Who is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor, or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of powers.
Executive orders.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Today, we're picking up a question from one of your fellow listeners slash classmates who asked, if there is a separation of church and state, what's the deal with the Pledge of Allegiance and the swearing on the Bible thing? Well, our guides today are two of the American history guys from Backstory. Ed Ayers, who specializes in 19th century American history. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Virginia.
And Brian Ballow. He is master of the 20th. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Virginia.
So who wants to pick this one up? How did the founders address the separation of church and state originally?
Gingerly, I would say. You know, it's interesting that it actually begins in Virginia with Thomas Jefferson. There's a kind of swirl of these new religious groups around these people that are called evangelicals who are starting their own churches and are not waiting for the Church of England to tell them where they can and what kind of training the ministers are going to have. And Jefferson in the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom says, that's okay. We're not going to tell you what you can believe. So it actually begins before the Constitution, and it grows out of the experience of Jefferson living in a surprisingly diverse religious environment.
Is that actual phrase, separation of church and state, ever used in the Constitution or the First Amendment?
Well, they use the language most famously in the First Amendment. And that First Amendment refers to the fact that there should be no law representing an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And that's become known as the establishment slash free exercise clause of the First Amendment of the Constitution. As Ed knows, they also used it in the body of the Constitution even before the Bill of Rights, but they used it in reference to office holders not being subjected to a religious test.
Mm-hmm. So no representative in Congress would have to go through some sort of religious qualification.
Exactly.
You know, I think it's worth pausing a little bit over establishment. You know, we think, okay, there can't be an official religion. And it does mean that, but what it mainly means is that people are not going to be taxed to support a church that is sponsored by the state. And this sort of fits into the general tenor of the Declaration of the Constitution, which is declaring all the things the state is not going to do. And so the state is not going to say whether you belong to a church or not, whether you believe in its tenets or not, you will be taxed to support it. So when they said there's not going to be an establishment of this church, that's really what they're talking about, because that had not been the practice before in many of the states. Now, we forget that, awesome as the Constitution is, it's the United States of America. And the very fact that separation of church and state grows out of a state context in Virginia should remind us that all 13 states have a different trajectory on all these. In New England, there's a much tighter connection between the government and the established church. In other places, it's a pretty ragged relationship. So they're trying to bring some kind of uniformity to this with the Constitution. And one of the things they're trying to do is say there will not be a national established church. But it takes a while for some of the states to make the same distinction.
Well, I'd love to hear some examples of that, because I'm thinking that, you know, these people made their way to what was to become the United States in the 17th and 18th century, fresh from a lot of wars, religious wars, a lot of bloodshed over religious differences. Now they have this new nation, no official national church. How was that enforced? Were there clear cases of violations being prosecuted in the 17th and 18th century?
We all know about the Puritans and how much of an identity there was between their idea of, you know, God's presence on earth and laws. People today in New England talk about the Blue Laws. It grows out of Connecticut and the Puritans. And that's pretty much the fact that you're having religious organizations making laws for everyone is one of the things that an established church brings. And this becomes sort of the source of tension over the next 100 years. Well, if a majority of us are Christian and we vote to impose these things, say, like respecting the Sabbath on everybody, is that legitimate? Is that crossing that wall between church and state? Or is that democracy in action? In many ways, I don't know, Brian, it seems to me that that is sort of the enduring thing here in American history, is the interconnection between religious belief and democratic expression of that at the polls.
That's exactly right, Ed. And as with so many issues that come down to a tension between individual rights on the one hand and the voice of the majority on the other, we avoid a lot of problems by just what you were talking about, Ed, by kind of letting the states themselves decide. So in Virginia, they get rid of the established church pretty quickly. In Massachusetts, the established church hangs on until the 1830s. So when Ed was talking about the state, he was talking about the United States of America and the national constitution. But one of the ways that we kind of sugarcoat these difficult tensions is by localizing them, letting individual states themselves decide about these kinds of tensions between individual rights in this case and the democratic will on the other.
And here's a little bonus question for Civics 101. When I was in school, a question often was, what's the longest word in English in the dictionary? And the answer always was anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about what that means, it's exactly what we're talking about here. It's anti-disestablishmentarianism. And so it's people who are trying to disestablish the church in Massachusetts and people opposed to that. That gives you some idea. This is so complex, it takes the longest word in American history to describe it.
Well, I'm also thinking about, you know, the difference between a secular state. Say the French revolutionaries, their goal was to de-Christianize the Republic and establish a secular state. So what is the difference between that establishment of a rigidly secular state in France and the separation of church and state here in the fledgling Republic of the U.S. and the country we live in today?
Well, Virginia, one of the answers is exactly what we were just talking about, and that's the power of a strong centralized state. You know, even today, that if you've been to France, things get controlled in Paris that radiate out across the entire nation. And France viewed itself very much as a single nation. We viewed ourselves as a republic and in many ways a collection of republics. So one answer to your question is that we did divvy out these decisions to the various states and then within the states, the localities themselves. The second answer is that we, unlike France, were becoming a more Christian nation. I would defer to Ed on this one, but we were certainly becoming a more evangelical Christian nation in the early 19th century, actually after the founding. Would you agree with that, Ed?
Yeah, I'd say, Brian, that in France, the idea became, and again, it's tied into power and money, you know, that people had seen the Catholic Church as exerting way too much influence in French society. Here, the idea was, we're not going to establish one church because there's going to be this free market for many kinds of churches. You know, when Jefferson writes that Virginia Statute, he doesn't right. just talk about Christian and non-Christian. He talks about the Hindu and Muslim and infidels, is actually in the sentence. And so the idea is, here in America, we are going to have a free market of religion in many ways, like we have a free market of the economy. So France looks to suppress what religion they have, which feels to be too much. It's anti-clericalism. In the United States, it's like taking the lid off and let's let religion flourish. And it does. As Brian says, in the 50 years after the Constitution is ratified, religious belief of every variety just explodes across the country. It is really only then that you can talk about the United States being an evangelical nation. And those are, you know, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Baptists are the most rapidly growing denominations in the country. And the very fact that I use the word denomination suggests how multiplicitous Protestantism was, that we have to kind of break it apart in all mm-hmm. its different competing and yet cheerful different pieces. So the United States, if the intent of the Constitution was to suppress religion anyway, it did a really bad job of it because it really flourished.
Well, and you mentioned how ragged that idea was and how localized and state-based governance of religion or the separation of church and state became or didn't. And this is an argument that's often been made, that there is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. The founders were men of God. They were intent on establishing a Christian nation based on biblical values. Can they make that case?
In my opinion, no. The founders were pretty explicit about a lot of other things. You know, and that there's no reason for them to have hidden their beliefs behind silence on this front. That's what they thought. And Jefferson recognized and even celebrated the multiplicity of religion. I don't think he would have taken it for granted that there was one agreed upon set of principles that everybody would fall into if it were not laid out in the Constitution. That's what it looks like to me, Brian. What do you think?
No, I totally agree with that, Ed. And I would simply add that when they talked about not establishing a religion and they talked about the free exercise of religion, they were not in any way anti-religious or especially anti-Christian. It really did go back to what Jefferson said, which is that religion should be between man and his God. And I think he believed that. He had good reason to believe that. He had some pretty unorthodox religious beliefs himself. And he did not want the state or any central power telling him what his relationship between him and his God should be. And this goes back to one of these central tensions of individual rights and protected rights in the United States and the will of the Democratic majority. Certainly there were instances in the United States history quite early on where that came to the test. Ed could talk to you about the Sabbatarians who were very upset about the delivery of the U.S. mail on Sundays.
It's very interesting to think that President Trump seems to be an exception to this idea that had been common sense, that to be elected, certainly to presidency, you had to have a religious affiliation. And Trump won 80% of the evangelical vote without claiming any such affiliation. What do you make of that, Brian?
He worked really hard to get the endorsement of evangelical leaders, such as the head of Liberty University, for instance, Ed. And there are those who feel that Trump strongly backed positions advocated by Christian evangelicals, particularly when it came to appointing a Supreme Court justice who would challenge the existing law, Roe v. Wade, on abortion.
Yeah, that's right, Brian, that the relationship between church and state seems to have shifted from what person embodies my beliefs to what person is going to help enact the laws that protect my beliefs. That people seem to look to the presidency less right now as sort of the embodiment of their religious ideals and more as an instrument of their religious ideals. I think this surprised a lot of people. But you can understand why, given the history of church and state in this country, that people said, you know, what we are looking for is the freedom to exercise what we believe. And it seems to us that prayer in the schools is what we believe. Freedom of choice in schools is something we believe in. Having Roe v. Wade overturned is something we believe in. We don't care so much about what the particular religious beliefs of the president might be.
Well, how about this? You both have talked about the deep tension this has created in American life, both in the past and maybe resurgence now. Would the founders be satisfied with how the separation of church and state has been interpreted and has been lived throughout American history?
I don't know. They seem like pretty grumpy men to me, Virginia. Would they really be satisfied with anything?
Great answer, Brian. We're leaving that one to Ed, apparently.
Well, the answer would be no, because I think they would be surprised at how this is still an issue of debate and of Civics 101, that we still have to talk about this. They, I think, hoped, in the same way that they hoped other problems might go away, such as slavery, that the enlightened nation that they were creating would find ways to work through these problems. And the fact that we're still wrestling with the very same problems that they did, I think, might be a little disconcerting to them, grumpy or not.
And if I can have one more shot at a more serious answer, Virginia, I think what they might be most surprised by are the number of Americans who are agnostic or atheist. I do think that represents a very large shift from the 19th century, and I think they would be surprised to see that.
Well, Brian Ballow, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been great to talk to you, Virginia.
And Ed Ayers, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
I'm not going to reveal who is my favorite student at the moment. We're just going to leave that one out there.
I brought that apple for nothing.
And the crate of apples will be delivered to you from over here.
All right, that's it for today's lesson. If you're itching to be at the top of the class, you can sign up for extra credit. That's our weekly newsletter, where you'll learn things like which presidents were voted most popular and which didn't even make the yearbook. You can sign up for extra credit at civics101podcast.org, and that's where you can submit your questions by email or text or voice memo.
Hey there. I'm producer Molly Donahue. Here at Word of Mouth, we've been answering listener questions about this small, weird, wonderful state. And, oh boy, do you have questions. Earlier, we answered one involving an abandoned White Mountain ghost town. But that wasn't the only question you've asked about New Hampshire's secret places. Here's another one. Ready? You might want to brace yourself.
Is it true the New Hampshire Division of Historic Resources has a secret list of archaeological site locations to protect them from looting and development?
From New Hampshire's Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer, Richard Boisvert, here's the short answer.
In a manner of speaking, yes, we have a list. It is confidential, it's not secret. It's available to people who have a reason to know, and this would be the landowners. And it would be professional archaeologists who are doing the necessary research in advance of construction so that they can know where sites are located before they even go into the field.
If that's all you came here for, I'll give you a second to gather your things. Okay, the rest of you, circle on up. There is a list. The list itself is not secret. But some of the locations of the sites on the list may be confidential if there's a compelling reason. For instance, if there's a threat of looters stealing or destroying culturally significant artifacts. Now, you're thinking, we're in New Hampshire. Are looters really a problem?
Yes.
Well, you heard the man.
They're motivated by a variety of things. Sometimes it's just the thrill of discovery. Sometimes it's to sell the artifacts. But there are an awful lot of unauthorized excavations that go on. nearby our office here in Concord. It's a place at Garvin's Falls where there were a total of 104 looter pits.
The secrecy isn't just a New Hampshire Division of Historic Resources decision. It's federally mandated. The location of archaeological sites is actually exempted from Freedom of Information Act inquiries as a result of the 1979 Archaeological Resources Protection Act. But while sites out west, in the Great Plains for instance, might have beautifully preserved burial plots, our soil in New Hampshire is way too acidic for that. So what are people finding?
In that instance, they were probably looking for things like arrow points, spear points, fragments of prehistoric pottery.
And according to Tanya Krasik, records coordinator for the division, there's a lot of history unique to New Hampshire out in those hills too.
And so then for the post-contact or historic sites, those are more recognizable. So you're looking at old house foundations, barn foundations. There's a lot of older industries in New Hampshire, like logging and lumbering. So there's a lot of sawmills around. So you'll see that around the waterways in New Hampshire too.
And the oldest artifacts found in New Hampshire?
The oldest artifacts in New Hampshire were found at a site called Tennant Swamp in Keene. They radiocarbon date to about 12,500 years ago. That date was done on some charcoal found in the site, and found with it were a large number of scrapers and two fragments of spear points.
So yes, there are confidential site locations to protect them from looting, but the New Hampshire Division of Historic Resources also wants to help people get out and help dig at those sites. Interested in joining in the search for some of the oldest archaeological finds in the state? You can join in one of the digs as a volunteer this summer. There's more information at our website.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At the age of 50, the spreadsheet of Arthur Less's life runs in the deficit column. He's a mediocre lover, a middling success as a novelist, and he's determined to be as far away as possible when his former lover marries a younger man. So he accepts every invitation for guest teaching spots, obscure award ceremonies, and literary residencies, and sets out on a hodgepodge, hapless, frequently humiliating odyssey across the world. And he will be at Writers in the Loft Monday, July 24th. Andrew Sean Greer, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
I gave a brief sketch of Arthur Less. Tell us more. Who
great.
Is he?
That was so fun to listen to. Mediocre lover, what you just said about him is just the saddest thing to way to describe him.
Yeah, heck of a headline.
Because he's a great mediocrity. I think he's probably a better writer than he thinks he is, and I hope he's a better lover than he thinks he is, but he's not a genius, and he's aware of that. I think by middle age, you know if you are or you aren't, and when you realize you aren't, you have to kind of, all of us realize that, we deal with it. But he also has a childish sense of hope that things are really going to get better any minute, so he keeps taking chances and opportunities that are going to lead to disaster, thinking surely this is the way out. And writing him that way was endearing for me, because it isn't a cruel book, you know. It makes fun of him, but he's has so much more hope than most of us do that it meant that you knew he was going to go on.
Yeah, he's a tender-hearted guy, as you said, an optimist on some level. But he plans this escape, and there's a different chapter for each of his stops. In Mexico City, he goes to interview a much more popular science fiction writer. He goes to Turin for an award chosen by high school students. Berlin, where his bad German leaves his students pretty confused but kind of dazzled. Morocco, Japan, a residency in South India, actually for Christian writers, which he is not. He's setting himself up in a lot of ways. I'm wondering what inspired this kind of dislocated setup for you.
Well, it started off as a very different novel. And I kept wanting to write these other chapters remembering his travels, because they just seemed had so much more material and so much more fun. And at one point, I just cut the framing plot and went straight into the travel, and so invented a plot where he got to travel around, because it just... I was enjoying writing that part so much more. And when you're a writer, you really go for what you're enjoying. That's the sort of key.
Well, and it is a very different novel for you, too. The story of a marriage, the impossible lives of Greta Wells, the confessions of Max Tivoli. I mean, heavy books in many ways. So did you set out to write something funny? Because this book is really funny.
I'm glad to hear that. I didn't at first. And then, you know, I was writing a book about like a sort of poignant book about a man, and I just couldn't feel sorry for him. So I decided I would just flip everything over and make fun of it instead.
What do you mean you couldn't feel sorry for him?
In the book, there's someone who says it's hard to feel sorry for a middle-aged white guy. And that is how I felt about my character. Mm. I was like, I don't know. These aren't really big problems. So it was more fun to have the same problems, but ridicule him and try and sort of in a way of saying, like, it's really not that bad, Arthur Less.
One of the really poignant things is that, you know, this is a gay man who came out in the 1980s. And in the book, it says, Arthur Less is the first homosexual ever to grow old. He has never seen a gay man age past 50. So what kind of examples does he have?
Yeah, that was something that I had thought about, because it's true of my generation that there was this, the whole generation in front of us was decimated by AIDS. And I'm just young enough that when I was a college student, we all survived, but the grad students, none of them survived. So the whole generation ahead of me, the first generation of men to be out, really, they all vanished. So we're the first generation of gay men to have to figure out how to get to 50, 60. I've never seen it before. Obviously, there are closeted gay men who did it, and there are plenty of men who survived and have these brilliant lives, and I look at them. But, like, my friends are all getting white hair, and we think, okay, do you dye it? You don't. That's what you need to know. And it's sort of funny to have to struggle your way through something that everyone else has to find their way through anyway. You could do it the way straight men do, I guess.
Aging is often the punchline in stand-up, too, you know, right? Aging is sad and funny in its own way.
It's so awkward that your body turns on you in that way. Just like when you're a teenager, you know. Of course, what's funny is when you try to struggle against it. It's also funny just to just relent, just get old, which is what you really have to do. But it's hard.
Well, in addition to aging, he's trying to hang on to some kind of career. I mean, this is a guy who is big in Italy, I guess. and he goes there and he's, you know, looking out over this crowd of high school students that are going to decide his fate. And he looks out over another crowd of young people who've come to see his 11 p.m. reading in Berlin in a subterranean grotto, and remarks this is a place where writers still matter. So is this what you've observed of a writer's life, this constellation of academics and conferences and teaching positions scrabbling their way through?
And it's such a strange career. It's feast or famine, you know, which is what's so disconcerting. You can't set up expectations. You will be at entirely humiliating events where one person shows up and you've decided to play ukulele for this event. And so you're playing ukulele to this one person and it's just devastatingly humiliating. And you have done it to yourself. And then you go to something that's outsized where it's 3,000 people in some sort of amphitheater and they've decided to invite, of all people, you. And then you have to also play ukulele and you think, well, this is wrong too. This isn't appropriate. I shouldn't be doing this. Why'd you ask me? Writing does really matter in certain parts, but then like the very next day, you're nobody again. So a lot of humility is needed. And luckily, there's plenty of humiliation to bring that about.
Huh. So maybe rethink the whole ukulele thing for you?
I'm not doing it on this tour. I did it for 20 events in a row on the last tour. Almost broke me.
Well, there is one humiliation following the other for him. There was an excerpt from this in The New Yorker about the time in Turin. Do you have a favorite kind of setup for Arthur that you created?
In the chapter in Germany, I really enjoyed the fact that he tries to speak German. And the whole chapter is translated from German into English, so you get to hear everyone else speaks perfect. You know, they're speaking German, but his is so awkward. And that was really fun to do, because so often in books, we make fun of people's bad English. And I thought, we must sound ridiculous in other languages. And that was a joy. I just couldn't stop writing that.
He says to his students on the first day, "I am sorry, I must kill most of you."
And he never knows. He never gets it. He's thrilled. He thinks he speaks German, which is, you know, he does perfectly fine in the end.
Well, we're very aware in this book, because he is in the writing universe, who's hot, who's not. He's an aging gay male writer, one who never made any list of best writers under 30 or 40 or 50, and they stopped making them after that. At one point, a fellow novelist tells him, you know, it's not that you're not a great writer, you're not a great gay.
It certainly seems like a bizarre thing to say to someone, but maybe the kind of comment someone would make. I think that there's, as writers, we're not just being judged on the words we write on the page, but kind of who we are and what we stand for. And we don't know who we are or what we stand for. We're hardly in control of the book we're writing. So the things people say about us are, they act as if we've planned every single thing out when we don't even know what we wrote.
Hmm. I think that's true. You know, you read a book and you think you know who the author is. And obviously enough of us have written college papers deconstructing a book that we think we know what they're all about.
Well, I know coming from the other, I had to at some point jettison everything I learned in college about sort of meaning embedded in a text, because I realized that the author did not put it there. You know, you can't approach writing that way, trying to have it mean something. You have to make the thing in your head the way you feel you have to make it and just see what happens. That's scary when you know people are going to judge it.
Well, and also you will be judged or maybe pegged. I mean, that is, you know, is the headline next to Andrew Sean Greer, gay male author?
It never has been. I don't know why. It's been interesting to watch. I have other friends who are pegged and they don't make it onto the mainstream fiction bookshelf, which I think is a shame because they're great writers, but somehow they got put on a different shelf.
Right.
I think it's happening less and less.
I'm speaking with Andrew Sean Greer. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and we're talking about his new novel. It's called Less. Since the book is about a writer who lived for some time with a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and thank you, by the way, for identifying Pulitzer, not Pulitzer, for us. Did you get a good source on that?
I looked from the website itself.
But it's about doing the work. He's remembering his life with this poet and the habit of work. Everything has to be sacrificed for the work, and plans have to be canceled and meals delayed and liquor brought as soon as possible or poured down the sink. There's this demon in the house, and the other demon is doubt. I wonder if you could read us a little bit about that.
Life with doubt. Doubt in the morning with the oil beating on a cup of coffee. Doubt in the pee break, not catching his eye. Doubt in the sound of the front door opening and closing, a restless walk, no goodbye, and in the return. Doubt in the slow sound of typewriter keys. Doubt at lunchtime, taken in his room. Doubt vanishing in the afternoon like the fog. Doubt driven away. Doubt forgotten. 4 in the morning, feeling him stirring awake, knowing he's staring at the darkness, a doubt. Life with doubt. A memoir.
Andrew Sean Greer reading from Less. Is that a memoir you could write, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that paragraph, I'm realizing, is the first thing I wrote in this book.
No kidding.
Yeah.
This also, ultimately, this is a novel of humiliation and of aging and doubt, but it's also about love and the fear of asking for love or staying with love over time. There's a character in the book, she's been left by her longtime partner, and she says, we know there is no love of your life, the lightning strike. That doesn't happen. It's walking the dog so they can sleep in and doing the taxes and cleaning the bathroom without hard feelings. And there's this question that comes up is it that? Is it the lightning bolt or the good, dear thing, you know, this destructive madness? What would Arthur Less say, and what would you say?
Well, I wrote the book because I don't know. Is it? I mean, I hope it's the good, dear thing. It should be. But what if it isn't? I mean, that's what she goes through. You live your whole life saying, like, it's the good, dear thing. It's the tedious days and someone who's on your side. But what if, and I've seen it happen to people, they're struck by lightning. They leave their family and partner. They go off with this other person and then they're happy. Wouldn't it be awful to know that's the other possibility, that you're wrong? it is Romeo and Juliet.
It's hard to sustain.
Yeah, hard to sustain.
Arthur Less is a man who somehow is not hardened by the world in the way that others have become. In creating this character, this optimistic character, did you carry away any different sense of hope?
You know, I really did. It was, the pleasure in writing the book was not in torturing Arthur, but being with him where he was hopeful throughout every page, no matter what I did to him. That made me really happy. And writing isn't necessarily a happy process, as anyone out there who writes knows, but this was. I recommend having a character like this once in a while.
Andrew Sean Greer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Sean Greer will be reading from and talking about his novel Less at Writers in the Loft on Monday night, and you can find more information about it at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. Don't forget there is loads
more... Wait. I have one more thing.
Okay, shoot.
So earlier in the episode, Molly mentioned that the good people at the Division of Historical Resources are giving amateur archaeologists the chance to do some guided digging at sites in New Hampshire. And, drum roll please, there's going to be a dig at Livermore.
Really? So more ancient Pepsi cans?
Well, maybe. But this field school will be down the road a bit from the Shackford camp in a part of town that was known as Livermore Falls. So you won't be digging in the Shackford's backyard or anything, which is, you know, nice for them.
So is the idea to help treasure hunters get it out of their system or what?
No, it's actually pretty legit. I talked to Elizabeth Muzzy at Historical Resources, and she said that the point is actually to figure out what happened at Livermore Falls. So who lived there and what life was like and everything like that. For most people, Livermore Falls is just this place with river access and a beach, but it's got this long history of industrial use. So the end goal of the field school is to reveal that history to the public.
You mean instead of just taking souvenirs from historical sites?
Exactly, which, as Molly figured out, is considered pretty uncool.
So this is real archaeology.
Yeah, the field school program has actually been around for decades, and it's apparently launched some careers in archaeology. Either way, it's a good chance to spend some time in crumbling foundations speculating about their mysterious history while an expert explains how not to ruin everything.
So if you're someone who, say, has an outsized fixation with ghost towns, this could be just the thing for you.
Yeah, you might have a point there.
So when is this all going down?
SCRAP, that stands for State Conservation and Rescue Archaeology Program, runs from early August to early September. And like Molly said, there's going to be more info at nhpr.org.
Okay, got it. Anything else to add?
Oh, no, you can finish the show now.
Thanks so much, Hannah.
Thank you, Virginia.
And thank you for your listening time today. We're going to continue to answer all of your questions. So go to wordofmouthradio.org and look for the button that says Only in New Hampshire, and you can submit your questions about the state. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Mr. Scott Joplin. And as always, loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can excavate your own listening experience with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in Apple Podcasts or Google Play. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.